This is Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Liberian President Charles Taylor stepped down from power earlier this week, bringing an end to the 14-year civil war that plagued the country. But Liberia is still in a state of unrest as the two rebel groups, LURD, or Liberians United for Reconstruction and Democracy, and MODEL, the Movement for Democracy in Liberia, maintain their hold of large portions of the country, and mass looting and violence continue. This afternoon, renewed fighting erupted between MODEL and the government forces on the road between Monrovia and Buchanan, Liberia's second largest city. For an update on the situation, Peace Watch reached Martin Brown, a journalist with the Ducor Broadcasting Corporation in Liberia's capital, Monrovia.
Thousands of women, men, and children have looted the freeport of Monrovia. The LURD, who controlled the area, fired in the air to deter the looters. They even beat them with sticks, but with little or no success. Looters were seen carrying sacks of rice, Liberia's staple. The aid agencies have called for the deployment of more peacekeepers to secure what is left in their warehouses at the Freeport of Monrovia.
Mr. Brown, where is the new Liberian president, Moses Blah, while all of this is going on? And have the government, the military, or the peacekeepers done anything to attempt to settle the unrest?
The situation in the Habel, the peacekeepers, at least were able to send patrols there and talk with MODEL. Advancing troops to halt their advance. But you can understand that LURD is still in control of the port area. Now, an agreement was reached yesterday, negotiated by the American ambassador to Liberia, John Blaney, to have LURD turn over the port by noon tomorrow, and they will pull back about 22 miles from the capital to the provincial town of Tubmaburg. The government is concentrated within central Monrovia and the suburbs of Painesville and Finkhor. So it was not possible to have the government do anything about the violence and the looting in the areas of the port and also Buchanan.
So what exactly are MODEL, or the Movement for Democracy in Liberia, what are their demands? I mean, it seemed as though the primary goal of the rebel group was to move Taylor from power. And now that he's gone, everything one would think would settle back to so-called normal. Why hasn't that happened?
Well, it's probably because of the political arrangement that should have come out of Accra. That up now, they have not reached a consensus on the formation of a government that will replace Moses Blah. So this is where I think the problem is. I know that MODEL has stated that they didn't accept Blah as president because he's an extension of regime, if you will. But I think that they are still talking, and we hope that maybe in the next 10 days there will be a political resolution that will bring in the interim government, which will take over, I understand, by October 2nd this year.
So who would you say is really controlling things? I know it seems as though different rebel factions are controlling different parts of the country. Is that accurate?
That is accurate, yes. There is really no central government in charge. The government of Moses Blah controls maybe one-fifth of the country right now. And even with the fighting going on, the government is only relying on the peacekeepers and the American ambassador, who has been able to negotiate, with the two warring parties, MODEL and LURD. So there is really a confused state right now.
Why aren't the peacekeepers there in the mix at this point? I would think one would think that this is when they're most needed.
The peacekeepers are still flying in troops. They don't have that many troops on the ground, and their equipment, logistics, So it is impossible to have them deploy throughout the city and quell some of the violence. In fact, the aid agencies are saying that they will require more peacekeepers on the ground to ensure that the relief supplies that they are expecting come tomorrow or the day after tomorrow to be secure.
What about the role of the American soldiers? What role are they playing?
Well, the Americans have sent a team that is working along with the ECOWAS or Nigerian troops. They were part of the negotiations that Merck has agreed to pull back and give access to the peacekeepers to take control of the port. I think most Liberians are happy that America is somehow involved in the process, and they're looking forward to the deployment maybe by November of American troops so that more confidence can be built. Most Liberians think that if America were on the ground, say, now with their troops, it will help to stabilize the situation very rapidly. So we're hoping. We don't know what the decision from Washington will be, but that is the hope that most Liberians have right now.
Finally, Martin Brown, do you foresee political stability arriving in Liberia, say, a month or two from now, or do you think the fighting will continue?
Well, I think one of the first things is to have the peacekeepers deployed and have the various forces contained in certain areas. And then the resolution of the political crisis in Ghana. Once we know exactly who the interim president will be and the government that is coming, I think that things will begin to settle down. But in the absence of that, it's anybody's guess.
Martin Brown is a journalist with the Ducor Broadcasting Corporation in Monrovia, Liberia. We reached him late this afternoon. Last Saturday marked the 100th day of the occupation of Iraq, and casualties of both U.S. troops and Iraqis continue to rise. U.S. troops are expressing frustration with their prolonged presence in the region, and among Iraqis, anti-American sentiments have increased exponentially. In San Francisco last weekend, Veterans for Peace held its annual national conference to address these and other issues. Correspondent Sarah Olson was there and files this report.
This past weekend at the Veterans for Peace annual national conference, the group organized its strong stand against the war in Iraq into a unified call to end the continued occupation and to bring the troops home now. The conference lasted for 2 days with hundreds of veterans from around the country. Workshop topics included the economic cost of modern war, current U.S. interventions, depleted uranium and other toxic weaponry, and domestic repression and the Constitution. The group also voted to make Rachel Corrie and Philip Barragan honorary members and considered resolutions calling for the repeal of the USA Patriot Act, demanding that the U.S. refrain from unilateral action, and creating a plan to remove military recruiters from schools. Eric Johansson is the president of the San Francisco chapter of Veterans for Peace, which helped organize the conference.
Certainly the theme that we're covering, defeating militarism and the politics of fear, is particularly relevant, with fear being used as the primary political tool of the Bush administration and militarism the primary foreign policy of the Bush administration. So in many ways, we were trying to make this convention, in addition to an educational event for our members, we also wanted to use it as a social movement springboard to re-engage and re-energize the anti-war movement and hopefully renew the peace marches.
The top item on everyone's mind was the situation facing the troops occupying Iraq. Medea Benjamin is the co-founder of Global Exchange, which has started an occupation watch center in Baghdad.
Well, after talking to them for a couple of days and finding out how miserable they were, telling us that they were working 7 days a week, 12 hours a day, when it was 115 degrees out inside their flak jacket, it was 130 degrees, saying that they too had no air conditioning when they went home and tried to sleep at night, that they had mite-infested cots, that they didn't get any decent food to eat because they were eating MREs three times a day. And they said to us, maybe we knew what we were doing when we came here to get rid of Saddam Hussein. We have absolutely no idea what we're doing here now. We hate it here. The Iraqis hate us here. We want to go home.
Benjamin visited the troops while she was in Baghdad.
We were there at the very time that George Bush said, bring him on. And we watched the reactions of the U.S. soldiers. We were there at the going away party for members of the 3rd Infantry Division who thought they were on their way home and were celebrating their departure, and found out the next day they were not only not going home, but they were there indefinitely. And we were there at memorial services for soldier after soldier.
Many veterans were upset by the U.S. government's patriotic rhetoric. Supporting the troops, they argued, was an entirely different proposition when you saw U.S. troops poisoned by chemical weapons and depleted uranium from the U.S. arsenal, and while the services to veterans are being cut. Brian Wilson is a Vietnam veteran and an active member of Veterans for Peace. During the 1980s, he lost his legs while protesting the shipment of arms to Central America.
We have these cliches that are issued by our political spokespersons, so-called. We've been through this before, support our troops. What does that really mean? First of all, of course, if you really want to support the troops, you would bring them home because they're in harm's way. When they did come home, you'd provide them with lots of medical and psychiatric care for the wounds of the war, including the trauma wounds.
Nancy Lesson and Charlie Richardson are co-founders of Military Families Speak Out, an organization of families who have loved ones in the military. These family members are speaking out against the invasion of Iraq and the current occupation. They contend that the best way to support the troops is to bring them home immediately and end the U.S. policy of preemptive war. They address the conference on Saturday.
Our son Joe returned from Iraq, returned from a 9-month deployment on Memorial Day, and although we feel joy to see him back in the United States, we feel joy at his return. We cannot let go of our anger and our dedication because the occupation continues. Because as Joe returns, our friend Susan's son, Justin, remains in Iraq, and our friend Stan's son is sitting on an airfield now waiting to be sent over to Baghdad. It is not acceptable to replace Joe with Jesse. It is not acceptable to replace Joe with Japanese troops or Spanish troops or with Iraqis under U.S. control.
While the U.S. is involved in intervention in countries around the globe, as well as the occupation of Iraq, some veterans are beginning to focus on where the next generation of troops will come from. The military recruiting budget is up to $2 billion per year. Many recruits say that they joined the military for job training, money for college, or to gain direction and motivation in life. Veterans for Peace and other groups are quick to point out that 2/3 of all recruits never get any college funding from the military, and that only 12% of male veterans and 6% of female veterans have made any use of skills learned during their time in the military. Asif Ullah is with a group called Revolution Out of Truth and Struggle, or ROOTS, and works on counter-recruitment issues.
Just creating a culture of resistance is real important, and part of that is exposing people to an alternative perspective, which is so minimal. People are bombarded with image after image of glorifying the media. You don't really see PSAs on TV about have you joined the military, you could lose your limbs, you could experience racism if you're a person of color, you could experience rape and sexual harassment, violation if you're a woman. You might be asked to kill somebody, and like many servicemen, you might experience post-traumatic stress disorder. So these aren't things that you're exposed to. Once that exposure happens and that educational process is there and more young people are affected by it, that itself is a huge crux in moving towards more of a direction of resistance and really re-examining what it is I'm going to be going into for the next 8 years. So that education is key.
many of the veterans in attendance were involved in projects to end the use of dangerous, possibly illegal, or toxic weaponry. Mike Felker is a former U.S. Navy hospital corpsman. He is also a Philadelphia chapter member of Veterans for Peace and works with a campaign to ban landmines.
Globally, it's estimated there's 70 million mines in place. The U.S. has refused to sign the treaty to ban landmines because we are unwilling to give up landmines as a potential weapon. So although over 140 countries have signed the treaty and have agreed to not use, not produce, not transport landmines and diminish their landmine supply, the United States has not done that.
On Sunday, many of the veterans stayed to attend a demonstration at Lawrence Livermore Labs to commemorate the 58th anniversary of the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Demonstrators were particularly concerned about the lab's development of robust nuclear earth penetrator bombs, a nuclear buster bomb that burrows into the ground but leaves radioactive fallout. David Klein is the national president of the Veterans for Peace. He spoke at the demonstration about the importance of veterans standing in solidarity with the anti-war movement.
One of our messages is we remember Hiroshima and Nagasaki and say never again. So we're here to stand in solidarity, to try and bring some sense to this madness, to try and stop these people leading our government down a road of endless war. Because we believe today the thing that we need to do is bring the troops home now.
For Pacifica's Peace Watch, I'm Sarah Olson in San Francisco.
At its national conference last weekend, Veterans for Peace issued an honorary membership to the late Philip Berrigan, a World War II veteran who spent a total of 11 years in prison for acts of nonviolent civil disobedience. The group also issued an honorary award to International Solidarity Movement member Rachel Corey posthumously. 23-year-old Corey, a college student from Washington State, was run over by an Israeli soldier with a bulldozer while she attempted to prevent the destruction of the home of a Palestinian doctor. Corey's father, Craig Corey, also a Vietnam veteran, received the award on her behalf, and he gave the following remarks.
I can hear her laughing now. Veterans for Peace? No way! That's wonderful! And it is. Cindy came across a journal recently, a journal that she kept in the early 80s about the kids she was so totally involved in raising. She found there an entry from when Rachel was 2.5 years old. At 2.5, Rachel asked her mother, is brave part of growing up? I'd like to usurp this moment for some thoughts I've been trying to gather together on courage and to share at the same time some things about my daughter. The first is because I've been bothered by that issue for some time, and the second because I'm a very proud father, and I think on this afternoon I can get away with talking to you about her. I'm terribly disappointed and even ashamed that since 9/11, our leadership has not asked us for courage. Oh, they've told us not to be afraid, sure. They have their code orange or red or mauve or whatever. We ask, should we be afraid? No, nothing to be afraid of. The answer, just as we said last night, just you keep on shopping. As if fear were an embarrassment, something to look away from. How dangerous, how small, short-sighted, and dangerous. We know courage is not the absence of fear. In my experience, the absence of fear is often stupidity. No, courage only exists in the presence of fear. It is what you do while you're afraid. I talked to Rachel by phone before she left to go to Palestine and told her, you know, Rachel, you don't have to do this. It's okay if you don't go. No one will blame you. She said, I know, I'm scared, really scared, but I think I can do this, and I know I have to try. Is brave part of growing up? We know courage is not so hard to acquire. You can find courage by giving it to others. We've all done it. And Rachel did it too. She kept reminding us that nobody from the International Solidarity Movement had ever been killed. On February 7th, Rachel wrote to her mother, "I think about the fact that no amount of reading, attendance at conferences, documentary viewing, and word of mouth could have prepared me for the reality of the situation here. You just can't imagine it unless you see it. And even then, you are always well aware that your experience of it is not at all the reality. What were the difficulties the Israeli army would face if they shot an unarmed U.S. citizen? And the fact that I have money to buy water when the army destroys wells. And the fact, of course, that I have the option of leaving. Nobody in my family has been shot driving in the car by a rocket launcher from a tower at the end of a major street in my hometown. Ostensibly, it is still quite difficult for me to be held for months or years on end without a trial. This is because I am a white U.S. citizen, as opposed to so many others. Once you have experienced the reality of a world that isn't surrounded by murderous towers, tanks, armed settlements, and now a giant metal wall, I wonder if you can forgive the world for all the years of your childhood spent existing, just existing, in resistance to the constant stranglehold of the world's fourth largest military apparatus, backed by the world's only superpower in its attempt to erase you from your home. That is something I wonder about these children. I wonder what would happen if they really knew." On February 20th, she wrote to Cindy specifically about fear and courage in the face of that fear. "Love you. Really miss you. Bad nightmares about tanks and bulldozers outside your house, and you and me inside. Sometimes the adrenaline acts like an anesthetic for weeks, and then in the evening or at night, it just hits me again. A little bit of the reality of the situation. I'm really scared for the people here. Yesterday I watched a father lead his two tiny children, holding his hands, out into the side of tanks and a sniper tower and bulldozers and jeeps because he thought his house was going to be exploded. I was terrified to think that this man felt it was less of a risk to walk out in view of the tanks with his kids than to stay in his house. I was really scared that they were all going to be shot and tried to stand between them and the tank. This happens every day." We could see the source of Rachel's courage become the people she met in Rafah, the people she described as in it for the long haul, because they have no choice, because they have to be there, because they are living on the wrong side of the green line. She took strength from them as they now take strength from her. Solidarity. On February 28th, she wrote, "When I'm with Palestinian friends, I tend to be somewhat less horrified than when I'm trying to act in a role of human rights observer, documenter, or direct action resister. They're a good example of how to be in it for the long haul. I know that the situation gets to them, it may ultimately get them, on all kinds of levels. But I'm nevertheless amazed at their strength at being able to defend such a large degree of their humanity. Laughter, generosity, family time, against the incredible horror occurring in their lives, and against the constant presence of death. I felt much better this morning. I spent a lot of time writing about the disappoint of discovering, somewhat firsthand, the degree of evil to which we are still capable. I should at least mention that I'm also discovering a degree of strength and a basic ability for humans to remain human in the direst of circumstances, which I also haven't seen before. I think the word is dignity. I wish you could meet these people. Maybe, hopefully, someday you will." A little more than 2 weeks later, Rachel was to die defending the home of Dr. Samir and his family. Five of those people in Rafah she had come to know. In Rafah, they call her the woman who came to stop the tanks. In Athens, they call her she who would not retreat. We called her Rachie. So what courage can we take from Rachel's courage? Well, we can have the courage to pull ourselves together as a community. Instead of asking the meter readers to be spies on our neighborhoods, our leadership should have suggested block parties. Let's know our neighbors and friends from whom we can borrow a lawnmower or a cup of sugar. Not people who need to be watched with suspicion. We can have the courage to recognize other peoples of the world as essentially like ourselves. After all, we're a nation of immigrants, and these people are just our cousins from the old world. And we can have the courage to question our own nation's responsibility for the world in which we find ourselves. In her February 27th email, Rachel wrote, "I will say that I think the vast majority of us who are in some way passively supporting this genocide are unaware of what it is. March 16th, our family lost the most cherished sister and daughter. The world lost a woman who had clearly found her voice as a writer and was beginning to find her voice as a peace activist. Now we need your help. House Concurrent Resolution 111 calls for an independent U.S. investigation into Rachel's death. We need your and your congressional representatives' support getting that passed. So call, fax, email, or visit your representative and ask him or her to sign on to HCR 111. Ask them to contact the State Department and the White House to demand an independent investigation, and ask them to contact the Israeli embassy to demand the full release of the results of their military police investigation. Then make those same calls yourself. In closing, let me share the following passage. We are all born, and someday we'll all die, most likely to some degree alone. Our aloneness in this world may not anymore be a thing to mourn. Maybe it is a thing that has to do with freedom. What if our aloneness isn't a tragedy? Tragic passing of love affairs and causes and communities and peer groups. What if our aloneness is what allows us to speak the truth without being afraid? What if our aloneness is what allows us to adventure, to experience the world as a dynamic presence, as a changeable, interactive thing? Those are the words of Rachel Corey, written in the fall of 2002. And yes, Rachel, brave is part of growing up. Thank you.
Craig Corey, father of 23-year-old International Solidarity Movement member Rachel Corey, who was killed in March while protesting the destruction of Palestinian homes. Thanks to Stephen Donovan and Reem Kahuda of Pacifica Station WPFW in Washington for production assistance with that segment. Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced in Washington, D.C. Our producer is Scott Gurian. Our editor is Lona Elias. Our engineer is T from the Pattersons taking the train to Tibet. Our associate producer is Angelique Chauffard. I'm Verna Avery Brown, the executive producer. Thank you for listening.